Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought with Efroni Schlesinger. I apologize for the delay in the release of this podcast. Initially, I had intended on dedicating the episode to a Q&A of what had been covered so far, but the person of higher expertise that I plan on interviewing had to reschedule. Fortunately, though, that created an opportunity to explore one more approach before we move on, or before we have the Q&A, which is that of Rav Kook. Now, this piece may have been the most difficult piece of Rav Kook that I've ever encountered. As a testament to its complexity, what was a piece of 3-4 pages when it was written has an entire book dedicated to just trying to explain it. So I bought the book, went over it, and here we are. It's important to mention, though, that my depiction of Rav Kook's position will be heavily rooted in the author Chagai London's explanation of it. So what I'll try to do is, to the best of my abilities, paraphrase some of the ideas that are expressed and then perhaps explain them in simpler terms or more understandable terms, because the ideology, the ideas are very abstract and very complex, so I'll do my best to kind of get it across clearly. So Rav Kook starts with the following point. He says, if we want to understand the true reasons for the mitzvot, which won't become irrelevant when our cultural influences change, we must understand the full essence of human nature. What that means is as follows. We're a product of our time, of our reality, of our culture, and our experiences. And so when we look on the mitzvot, there is a risk that the mitzvot will always just be a reflection of what we value them to be, what we want them to be. And therefore, they're not anything objective and certainly not of eternal significance. They're simply, they facilitate whatever it is that you know, we find to be important and attribute the mitzvot that significance. Now, that's not exactly truth and it's not exactly objectivity. It's simply, we're just going to say that it is whatever it is that we want it to be. And then the reasons we give last year are not going to be satisfactory, for the people who are reading it next year. And that's the wrong approach to trying to understand the mitzvot. The mitzvot have objective value and meaning. They have eternal value and meaning. And so if you want to understand what the mitzvot mean on an objective level, a level that's not simply going to change overnight or change in the next few years or need kind of redefining in the near future, what we need to do is understand human nature. Specifically those parts of human nature that are never going to change. If we understand human nature fully, we can understand how the mitzvot are designed to sustain the souls of mankind eternally. Right? Because if we know those parts of us that will always be part of us, and not those parts of us which are extensions of fads or cultural influence or exposure or you know what have you, if we understand those parts of human nature that will always be a part of us, that have ramifications to our spiritual identity, to our souls, to our aspirations, then we can understand what the mitzvot are here to do on an objective level, an unchanging level, and an eternal level. And to that, in that note, Rav Kook calls out the Rambam for having really the first approach to trying to explain the mitzvot, but approach that is heavily rooted in the past. Right, the Rambam's approach to the Tamei HaMitzvot are almost entirely focused on the path, right? Redirecting perhaps our primordial tendencies toward idol worship in a more positive direction is absolutely critical, but the root of that notion is that the nature of the mitzvot become progressively less important since their divine imperative is in the past. This is distancing us from something in our past. And so the further we get from our past, the weaker the significance of that perspective on mitzvot is, the less relevant, the less powerful. Whereas in Rav Kook's estimation, or the way he sees mitzvot, they're fueled by past, present, and future. They're protecting us from our past. They're giving us meaning in the present. They're giving us aspirations for the future. And the significance of the mitzvot really derive their meaning and their power from these three levels of past, present, and future that are simultaneously the case and eternally the case and will always be the function of mitzvot to be really a product of the collection of these three considerations. And they'll therefore be eternally relevant. So then what Rav Kook needs to ask at this point, he says, so what are these spiritual components rooted deep in human nature? Right? What are we searching for spiritually? What are the existential questions? What are the necessities of the soul that are not temporal but eternal? They will always be the case. It will always be a point of significant spiritual focus for us. As much as we are human beings, this is what we'll be focusing on. What are those things? Well, he starts by saying what they can't be. He says, it can't be one singularly driving idea that motivates our spiritual pursuits. It cannot be one push, one thing that we're trying to do right. I'll explain what that means in just a moment. And he writes, even if it's an idea that is nice and important and meaningful and prevalent and remarkably impactful, meaning you have one idea that meets all these criteria, it's a sensible idea. It is logical. It makes sense to us. It's also very nice and very important and really feels like it's giving us meaning. And I believe in it and you believe it and everyone around us believe in it. It makes sense. It resonates with people. It's still not that simple. We cannot simplify the entirety of our spirituality to one force. And the example he brings is being a good person. He's like, it can't be that simple. It cannot be as simple as be a good person and this will provide you with eternal spiritual satisfaction. You will forever be content with your aspirations. Your soul will feel complete and feel content because you're aspiring to be a good person. Rav Kook does not believe that it could be that simple. Striving only to be nice cannot possibly satisfy the complex demands that the soul asks us of. And I think that we have sort of an innate longing for greater meaning and significance, that being nice alone or kindness alone will never satisfy. The moral duties of the soul are contending with a far more nuanced perspective of meaning than kindness alone. On an existential level, this is not what does it for us. This is not the epitome of our aspirations to just be kind. I think that on a spiritual level, we realize that meaning and satisfaction means or entails a lot more than the simplicity of one single aspiration. The notion that being right is a far more complex demand than being nice or being kind hits us in a number of sensitive areas, right? For example, are there things that you would do knowing it would hurt someone else if you believe that that thing is right? Do you take away freedoms that you believe are being misappropriated if you believe that it is wrong to act in a certain manner? Right, these are things that are very sensitive topics, more so in some areas than in others. I could say in Israel, it's a very sensitive topic in the broader culture, as far as any religious influence that religious people have in the country to paint it as a more prominently religious, idealistic country is going to come at the expense of the freedom, the comfort, and the convenience of the people who don't believe in that. So there's a very relevant discussion to be having that doing what's right, and I'm not taking a stance on what is and is not right, I'm simply suggesting doing what's right is obviously more complex than doing what is nice or what is kind, and I don't think that we get such a spiritual satisfaction from living our lives around being nice in the face of being right. I think that our true satisfaction will often come from the difficult decisions that we make to do something that we know will be difficult and perhaps not perceived positively, but that we do believe is correct in nature. And another significant aspect of this discussion to consider is who decides what kindness is? And how do you know that you can trust your objectivity towards your own conclusions? In this debate, the people of Sodom come to my mind first because they're most notably identified by their immoral behavior. But they believed that what they were doing, they were compelled morally to interact with one another in the way that they did, which sounds kind of odd, but they had a purely what they believed to be an ethical aversion to helping people. Because in their estimation, assistance cripples potential. They didn't believe in perpetuating dependency of others. Right? You do it, you learn how to do it, you try to do it until you learn how, and then you can do it and you're far better off than if I had done it for you. Now, I think their radical position has taken very often inhumane, has taken a bit of an inhumane stance on the matter, but it definitely touches on the complexity of the dangerous assumption made about being kind. This is just, it is a concept too simple, and the reason I'm putting so much time into it is because it's something that I've heard. It's something that I've heard discussed by people who are looking for meaning, people who are looking for value and find certain aspects of religion to be overly demanding and unnecessary and insignificant and not meaningful, and deciding to focus their lives on a kindness-centric path as the ultimate end-all be-all of spiritual satisfaction or aspiration or satisfaction for the soul. And you know, from the time I was a young age and I started to hear that, I just knew deep down this cannot be the epitome of human beings, to pursue being nice. There's often more to it than that in situations which demand difficult decisions in the face of what might be ethically correct. In which case, all of that really, I mean, this was a bit of a tangent, but the bottom line is that no one impulse can properly encapsulate our spiritual experience. We want more than kindness gives us. We want difficulty. We find meaning in it. And very often, that's going to result in making difficult decisions that we may not feel comfortable making. Now, Rav Kook doesn't say so explicitly, but this comes kind of on the tail of approaching the Rambam's opinion, and this is a bit of a knock to the Ramban, to Nachmanides' approach, which we covered inside, and the Ramban characterizes the mitzvot as really personal refinement, which is a little bit more complex in a sense than a single motivating factor of being nice, but at the same time, it is very one-faceted. Right, being a better person through the character refinement that mitzvot provide is a relatively simple, as far as the reasons for the mitzvot go, that was certainly the most simplistic approach, at least on its face value. And this sort of cook is similar to the Rambam. He doesn't reject the significance of its role to play within a broader system of reasons for mitzvot, but he does not believe that this can be ultimately what mitzvot are coming to accomplish. It's too simple. It's not satisfactory enough. It's not even objective enough to give us a sense of spiritual satisfaction. So Rav Kook goes on to say as follows, even though the soul is infinite and indivisible, we're going to enumerate four levels of the soul as they pertain to their influence on human nature, right? And the soul is influent. It's not a strictly definable. It doesn't have limits. It doesn't have limitations. It's not a very definable entity. But as far as its relation to the human experience, we're going to break down the soul's experience or aspirations to four different levels. If we understand those levels in theory, both individually and as a cooperative unit, we'll understand in what areas we will always need spiritual satisfaction. So again, what we're looking for now is what aspects of the soul are deeply, deeply tied to human nature, to the extent to which the soul will always long for these things. It will always want these things. Having these things will always give it satisfaction. And then if we can identify exactly where those things are found or provided through the mitzvot, then we'll understand what the mitzvot are coming to do. It's coming to solve an eternal existential issue in human spirituality. Right? Then we can identify, he goes on, then we can identify within the mitzvot how they are designed to facilitate that satisfaction and gain a deep understanding of their actual purpose, as well as a newfound appreciation for their performance. Right? A newfound appreciation for their performance, meaning if you know why you need this, then you are far more motivated to do it. Especially if doing it seems more appealing than the alternative of the spiritual deficiency that you are left without it. So let me give you the following example that I think helps me put this whole idea and most of what's said so far into a little bit of a context. So for those who have had trouble following the ideas thus far, let me try to wrap this up in one idea before we go on to really convey what exactly we're looking for, what Cook believes mitzvot are, and then what we are looking for right now. And that'll set us up for the next stage of his thought. If you have, imagine you have a very deep passion for music. You feel like it's the only form of real expression that you have. And if that's the case, then you'll need to find a way of filling that hole. The hole that you have because you're not expressing yourself in a deep and a personal way. You have a certain affinity and certain connection to, you know, to the art of music. And you need to find some sort of outlet in that area in order to express yourself and resolve the difficulty that you may be feeling that expression is missing from your life. Now, that may be practically where you might find that. Maybe that's composing, learning how to compose music, or perhaps mastering a certain instrument, or maybe many instruments, perhaps performing for other people those instruments, or maybe it's lyric writing, and that will never be easy. I mean, mastering an instrument, that's not an easy task. Learning how to compose, these are not easy things. It'll never be easy. It'll be demanding, and it'll be difficult. It requires time, it requires effort, it requires self-discipline. But if you know that the need that you have towards this will never leave you, and you can't really tolerate living with the emptiness that you have without music or without this form of creative expression, then you will be willing to weather that difficulty because it's the only path to self-fulfillment. And I just think, and this may be my biggest takeaway from Rav Kook's idea, I think that is a remarkably beautiful way of seeing mitzvot. I've never considered them in that light before. To take that example, essentially what that would mean is that there is a certain spiritual emptiness, right? A certain perhaps existential crisis, but a certain lack of satisfaction, a hole on some level that by the extension, the mere extension of being human beings, we have, and we long for something more important. We long to be a part of something more significant. We long for spiritual satisfaction, a certain type of intangible happiness or sense of importance or value that cannot be bought. We long for this, and the mitzvot are designed to fill in that hole, to address the deficiencies that human beings have by their nature. And mitzvot are not easy. Like, by no means are they easy. And the deeper you get into them and the more meticulously you study the laws regarding them, by no means is it an easy task to fulfill these commandments. It's time consuming and it is effortful, and it requires a nearly impossible or inhuman amount of self-discipline in order to accomplish anything in the realms of keeping commandments, following the commandments. But if you're able to understand what, based on simple human nature, you lack, and you're able to identify where in the mitzvot there is an address or a satisfaction towards those deficiencies, the difficulty will become significantly less significant, in a sense, because you're willing to weather that difficulty if it means getting the satisfaction that they provide once you've bought into the concept that this hole that you feel will never go away, and the mitzvot can very effectively drive them away. Now, that may require being significantly bought into this system. I mean, I could speak just from my own experience for what it's worth, the personal degree of passion and value and meaning and purpose, I think is probably the best word, purpose, that the mitzvot have provided me with. It's exceptional, the far-reaching nature of the mitzvot to provide every aspect of your life with meaning. And this is meaning, profound meaning, is just something that you can't go your life without, regardless of what you may have in the physical realm. So that was really by way of introduction, more so than anything else, because that was just establishing the need. That was establishing the idea. The idea that we're searching for right here is human beings lack things, or we long for things. We have certain desires that are not timely desires, rather eternal desires. They are linked entirely within our existence as human beings. It's human nature. And the mitzvot come to address these things. They provide satisfaction, a framework for carrying out these aspirations that we have. And in that sense, they are able to, on an eternal level, satisfy us. Now, but what we need to discuss now is really the meat and potatoes, which is, okay, what are those things? You know, as of right now, it sounds like an excellent theory, but what are those things? And how convinced am I that they're not bound by time if any author is a product of their time and is going to be writing in a way that is at least moderately subjective? If this book is picked up 50 years from now, if it's picked up 500 years from now, will these things still be the case? Or are we limited by our perception and by our influences at assessing the objective needs of human beings? So Rav Kook maps out really these things that are, what we'll call them, we need to see what these things are that the souls of all mankind long for eternally. And Rav Kook maps out these four things are Ruach HaElokim, Ruach HaMusar HaMuchlat, Ruach HaEmunah, Ruach HaLeumit. So I'm going to translate them poorly for a moment, and then we'll try to translate them better. I'll translate them poorly because there's no way to translate them without explaining them, but at least we should all be on the same page for roughly what they kind of literally indicate. So the first one, the Ruach Elohim, would be some sort of godly-oriented spirit. The Ruach HaMusar HaMuchlat will be the ethically-oriented spirit. The Ruach HaEmunah is the faith-oriented spirit, and the Ruach HaLeumit is the nationally-oriented spirit. These phenomena of the human experience, these are the phenomena in the human experience that are eternal, and that most powerfully impact a person's spiritual composition. So now let's get into each one and take the time to understand them both individually as well as understand them as a collective, cooperative unit, how they impact each other and form a system. Ruach Elohim. Here, Elohim does not mean God exactly. Rather, it means a part of God that we pursue. the part of God that we aspire toward, and that is his perfection and his infinity. By aspiring towards completion, we aspire toward God. We have a bold and uncompromising aspiration to encroach upon perfection and to encroach upon infinity. That's what we want. We want perfection. We want infinity. That's what we're aspiring toward. Now, it's human nature to try to exceed that nature which we are limited to by weakness or by insufficient abilities. Right? We constantly aspire to what exists beyond the limited reality that we currently preside in. That's not exactly a novel idea. I mean, that's something that every single person can relate to in their own level. Even seemingly the most content people, people who are entirely content with even mediocrity, people who seem to have no aspirations in life, even they are resolute about aspiring towards some higher form of what they are right now. Imagine you've been doing nothing but playing video games for the last 20 years, right? In your parents' home, and anyone who looked at you would say, well, you have no aspirations in life. You do not meet this criteria of someone who aspires towards eternity or aspires towards perfection. There's no doubt in my mind that that's not the case. It just has a different representation, a different manifestation in any individual. For example, whatever level that you're on in your video game, you're not content staying there. Whatever your best time is in defeating a game, a level, I'm not really a video game person, but whatever your best time is, you're not content with that. You want to do it 1 second better. You want to get to the next level. You want to perform what you're doing a little bit better than you can right now or than what you initially assumed your potential to be. You're never content with staying who you are. You're never content with where you are. And that's not just because it gets boring playing the same level over and over again, but it is dissatisfying to be in the same place and to be without accomplishment or growth. You always want more than you are. What people don't appreciate necessarily is this is a certain natural urge that we have to aspire toward God and kind of an ideal perfection or a perfect state, a completion. By our human nature, we lacked, and we try to exceed our boundaries to fill in what we lack, be better than we are, be bigger than what we are now. Aspire to be a little bit, to go beyond our current existence. Now, we want to understand more, right? This has a lot of manifestations, right? We want to understand more. We want to feel more. We want to live more. And the Ruach Elohim is the instinct that we have to connect to the infinity or to the more than what we are, to be more than we are. That is the Ruach Elohim. That is a part of human nature. It is a part of nearly everyone who lives and ever has lived, a basic aspiration to be more than they are right now, especially in the areas that they value. Now, this is it expresses itself practically in a number of ways that are very common in the human experience, and that is our pursuit of knowledge, for example. Our pursuit of knowledge is not just an entirely practical endeavor. It really is a completing process. It is a pursuit that we feel we're filling in gaps in our own knowledge or in our own being by becoming more knowledgeable and understanding more of what goes on around us of ourselves. Having new experiences, right? We're not content with the old experiences, not necessarily because they're boring, but because they're the same. And we want to be more than we are. We aspire to be something that is a little bit beyond what we currently are. Leaving a legacy and having kids, or else leaving a mark on this world in some degree. These are all reflections of wanting to be more than we are. If you think about it, the idea of leaving a legacy or leaving a mark on the world is curious. The moment that you are gone, you don't care. It matters to us so much to leave a mark on the world, but the moment that we're gone, we don't care necessarily. So why is this so important? It's a problem. It's a depression that we never need to face, in a sense, if we're purely logical, right? I once heard a nice idea. It's probably not an actual story. It may have happened, may not have happened. It's a cute just idea. And that is, you know, a certain man was stressing about mortality. You know, the idea that it's all going to come to an end, the idea that he doesn't have here forever, you know, what's going to be, how long does he have? It was stressing him out remarkably. And so he goes to his friend and he asks, I need to know, how do you deal with this? I'm having a lot of trouble. And his friend responded, I really couldn't tell you. I'm never going to die. See, I don't have this problem. I'm immortal. I'm never going to die. I've never had to face this kind of existential crisis of, hey, it's all coming to an end. And his friend looked at him, you know, kind of curiously and says, well, what do you mean? Of course you're going to die. Everyone's going to. There's nothing exactly that you can do to stop it. I'm not sure what you mean. Could you explain? And he says, yeah, well, you know, I'm never going to die. Well, either I'm never going to die, or I am going to die, but I'll never have to worry about it once it's already happened. Meaning, and that's a very interesting approach, in a sense that it doesn't make sense to worry about this. Why? Because if you live your entire life as if you're going to die, the first time you're proven wrong will be the time that you no longer care. In which case, it's interesting, it's curious that leaving our mark on the world is so important when ultimately, when that either becomes the case or does not become the case, is in a time that we no longer care. But it is a mere aspect of human nature to want to extend beyond our own existence, for some aspect of ourself to extend beyond our own mortal existence. We want to be more. We want to be more perfect, more complete, and more eternal, more infinite. And our desire to leave something behind is to leave a part of us that outlasted us, leave a part of us that is more eternal than the rest of us. Now, someone, you know, once pointed this out to me, and I think it's very interesting that people are obsessed, like literally obsessed, with absolutely meaningless accomplishments, like objectively just meaningless accomplishments. And it's a very curious phenomenon. Or alternatively, they're obsessed with being, with things being at their best when they experience them. If you have an older generation telling you that music was better when I was your age, or when I was a part of this same institution, that was in the glory days. This is what we used to do. This is how things used to run. These were the people that were there. We're obsessed with, as right or wrong, we're obsessed with the idea that somehow we were a part of this thing when it was better. What does that give us? What does that do? Who cares? And why are we so determined to talk about it as if it matters to anyone that it was good or better when you were there? It's this certain satisfaction that we have, because if we were a part of something at its best, then we're historical. We are a little bit bigger than ourselves because we were a part of something that will never die. And if we have an accomplishment, regardless of how meaningless, that accomplishment is going to outlast us. And so it gives us a sense of exceeding beyond our limited existence, which is a very interesting idea. I mean, if you look at, I don't know if you've ever read the Guinness Book of World Records, some of these things are ridiculous, just absurd, stupid, and meaningless. You cannot imagine. I mean, and they take years of practice to be able to do these things, to be able to break these records, and they mean nothing. Meaning, wouldn't you rather spend half the time being the 100th best at something that's actually important than twice the time being the best at something that just is of no objective value? Well, no, just because on we want to be the best at something. It makes us closer to perfection. It helps us exceed beyond our current existence and kind of leave a mark on the world. We left some part of us that lived beyond our experience and lived on after us. It is the most natural feeling to have. It is an inextricable part of the human condition. That's Ruach HaElokim. The next one is Ruach HaMusar HaMuchlat. Now, the word Musar here, I translate it as ethical. But the way that Rav Kook means it here is bringing abstract concepts of ideals down into practical behavior. Right? In short, it's about actualizing the ideal. We want to reach people beyond ourselves through our behavior and do good for them. And what we heard in that one statement was a mixture of the first and second idea, right? Now, the second idea is about behaving in a manner that reflects your ideals in an objective sense. That's what the Ruach HaMusar HaMuchlat is. It's following your ideals, behaving in a manner that is an objective, a behavior that is an objective representation of those ideas. But listen to the other part. We want to reach people beyond ourselves through our behavior and do good for them. Meaning, one of the primary motivating factors, and this is why there are levels of the soul, one of the primary motivating factors in doing good for other people is very self-interested. It's about being bigger than yourself, extending beyond your existence to impact other existences, right? Breaking past your natural barriers and becoming a force for good in the life of others. It makes you bigger than you are. You become you and some part of other people who are benefiting from you. And the more people that you are benefiting, the bigger you are, because you are a part of each one of them in the way that they are taking from you and benefiting from your existence. It makes your existence greater, relevant on a more broad scale and more far-reaching. It is kind of a self-aggrandizement in a sense, this idea that we want to impact other people, to expand ourselves to some degree. Now, this stems primarily from the first idea, that our impulse to extend beyond our current selves and become a force for good is an extension beyond your own existence, right? You bond with a person through their benefit from your impact, and you grow into something that is larger than yourself. Now, that certainly raises questions on altruism, no doubt. I mean, I don't know who does or does not believe in altruism, but that certainly casts a doubt of something that can purely be a kindness for the sake of other people. But meaning on a practical level, and something that perhaps most of us can identify with, how many of us dream of donating anonymously to an organization you're not even aware of, right? It's not as though an anonymous donor can look at the organization that is benefiting from his donation. He can be proud of it. He can believe in that organization and not necessarily care who knows and who doesn't that he donated to it, because he gets this self-satisfaction that this place is doing great and it benefited tremendously. I don't need other people telling me that. Okay, well, what if you can't even tell yourself that because you don't even know where you donated to or what the cause was? See, the less interaction that we have with the beneficiaries of our kindness, the less it speaks to us, because it feels more distant. It's harder to feel bigger and like we extended, like we did something important, like we impacted the world around us. If we have no interaction with what it is that we impacted, it feels like, you know, somewhere something benefited. So I guess there's some part of me that's bigger than my immediate existence. But at the same time, I have no idea where or what that is, and it's not so satisfactory. Now, we really we want to grow from a shared experience into something bigger than we are, which we can extend into. Now, although really all goodness is growth of oneself, and I'm not denying that, even if it's anonymous and you don't know where you give it, it is growth through impacting what is external to you, but it feels less, it feels lacking. Certainly is not as satisfactory. That doesn't mean it's worse. It is just, it doesn't give you the same sense of expanding your existence and interacting with things around you and being a relevant force in their existence, in their lives. So, with that, we'll advance to the third one, the Ruach HaEmunah. Now, Rav Kook can mean a few different things when he says Emunah. So, let's explain exactly what he means here. Emunah here means religion. Or even the more practical sides of religion, the dogma, if you will, right, as opposed to the spirituality of it. Humans desire to live religious lifestyles. We want to actualize our aspirations and our ideals in an organized system that standardizes them. We want our pursuit of perfection and will to do good to have a series of tangible behaviors that lets them act in perfect harmony with their ideals. We're not satisfied having ideals that are not expressed in an objective way. Ideals that don't manifest themselves in behaviors are not very helpful and not very satisfactory. To hold on to an ideal and to hope to have a general pursuit in the direction of pursuing your ideal is not as clearly satisfactory as having objective actions that you know are manifestations of your values. That is what organized religious practice is, in a sense. But I suppose, at least in this day and age, for sure, we do need to ask the question, is religious life actually inextricable from human nature? I mean, that's what Rav Kook put forward. These are not timely things. These are not timely or strictly currently relevant aspects of the human condition. These will always be the case. Now, today, I think it's interesting that we've seen a heavy shift toward the spiritual side of religion, or perhaps the obligation-free model of religion. And I at least would like to ask the question, could people be losing their need for organized religion? Or their desire? Or maybe their need as well, right? Is this an eternal part of us? Or can perhaps our experiences, or at least what we can personally attest to, indicate that maybe this is a little bit less of an objective aspect of the human condition? So I certainly don't believe so. First of all, I think whether people realize what they're missing or not, they're missing it. I don't know that it's valuable to quote this statistic. I've read it in a number of different contexts, but I haven't yet seen empirical evidence that it does indicate what, it is as a result of what it claims to be. But the mere fact of the quality of living in an objective sense worldwide, and especially in the United States and in largely capitalistic countries, is a higher quality of living than at any point in any country in all of history, and the commodities or the luxuries even that someone below the poverty line has today are beyond what the middle class had 50 years ago and the upper class had 100 years ago. And on an objective sense, we're living better. And yet, the suicide and depression rates are sky high. Sky high. And it's mind-boggling to consider how those two things exist in unison. How is it that we are living better but feeling worse? Living better than we ever have and feeling worse than we ever have. It's a very strange phenomenon. And so I think there is certainly something that material wealth and, you know, obviously does not give us. I think there's certainly something that we are lacking with the abrogation of religion or of belief. And I think that whether people want that or don't, or realize what they're missing or do not, is irrelevant. So maybe not everyone claims that they want it, but perhaps they don't truly realize that it's something that they're desperately missing. Now, more than that, I think that it's interesting to point out, at least in again, for what it's worth, my own analysis of the situation, I find that some of the ideologies that are most anti-religious, specifically religious dogma, but as well, they think the faith-based part is stupid as well, is not very significant. I mean, it's insanity. It is, you know, an archaic, you know, fantasy that once made sense to humankind before we were, you know, before the Enlightenment, before literacy, before we were actually intelligent enough to realize that it's, you know, it's lunacy to believe in half these things. And I mean, I think that it's interesting. Again, this is in my own analysis of the situation, that some of the most openly contentious ideologies toward religion, and specifically dogma in religion, have a very, very long list of ideals, of things that they believe in, that their ideology speaks about. They believe that everyone should have these ideals. Everyone must believe these things. And more than that is that these ideals have very, very objective manifestations, very objective forms of behavior that they believe everyone is either compelled to follow or to refrain from. I think that the objective manifestations of their ideas have come to regulate almost every part of life, both in what you cannot do and what you must do. And I think that there is punishment for not following the social norm, you know, whether it's in harsh condemnation or in things, you know, perhaps more cruel and more critical, more harsh. And lastly, I think this has even spurted violence perpetuated by some proponents of these ideologies. It has promoted, you know, it is justified violence in the name of belief. So what I find to be ironic is that some ideologies and some sects of ideologies that are most opposed to organized religion and dogma are becoming the most dogmatic ideologies that exist today. It's almost like when you run far enough in the opposite direction, you basically become the same person. This is religious extremism without God, essentially. And so, you know, you can agree or disagree with that estimation, but my personal experience is that I find people cannot do without what organized religion is. Now, whether or not that's an actual organized religion as we know it, or essentially organized religion with a different value, or replacing God with, you know, whatever ideology that you hold, we're not content with a belief. We want practical values. We want objective manifestations of those values, objective behaviors to be following. We want everyone to be following them, and we want systems for following them and consequences for not following them. That is an organized religion, regardless of whether or not it's in pursuit of God. And that is, I believe, a constant aspect, a constant part of the human existence. It's a part of human nature. It is what we want, always have wanted, and always will want in our value systems. We want our pursuit of perfection and will to do good to have a series of tangible behaviors that lets them act in a perfect in perfect harmony with their ideals. Now, to summarize what we've said so far before I go on to the fourth one, because the fourth one is a bit different qualitatively. They're all a bit different, and they're a bit of a progression, but the fourth one we'll see is a bit different qualitatively. So I'll summarize with the following words that the author writes himself. I'll paraphrase. Summarize what we've said so far. We'll phrase the first three ideals as follows. Ruach Elokim is the theoretical dimension. Ruach HaMusar HaMuchlat is the emotional dimension. And Ruach HaEmunah is the practical dimension. Okay. That being said, what are we missing? Well, what we're missing is the framework that these three dimensions require to exist in any practical level. Beyond the belief, the desire, and the action, as we've listed so far, is the need to live in a society. What does that mean exactly, the need to live in a society? Well, society here means the framework for reaching beyond yourself, becoming a force for good in the existence of others beyond yourself. It's the vessel where the vision for the ideal-centric organized behavior is carried out. It's the forum where the theoretical becomes the practical, and you need a forum. Now, society here, we have to be very careful, it doesn't refer to social interactions. It doesn't refer just to what I'm doing with you, what we have in common, are we friends, are we neighbors, are we business associates, what is the framework that we're interacting. That's a limited vision, that is a limited perspective on society. What we mean here is something more broad. What we mean here is a larger framework where people can interact with things beyond themselves in the manner that they believe to be appropriate, and where the existences beyond themselves, not just people, the existences beyond themselves, the things that exist, and not just people, not just animal, not just inanimate objects, the ideas, the concept of business, the concept of an economy, all these concepts that we are in charge of running and facilitating, we believe that there is a way to do them in accordance with our ideas and as a very practical manifestation of the things that we believe. Right? And we need a system to do those things. Right? Otherwise, we're stuck in a realm of theory. And even if we have objective practices that are representations of our ideals, a practice without an action is also a theory. It's a theoretical practice. Right? I mean, it's if you are the best at something, if you are the best basketball player, you have tangible, real skills. You don't just believe in playing basketball. You don't just value playing basketball. You're actually very good at it, but you have no ball and no court. It's theoretical. I'm not saying you don't possess the skill, you don't possess the talent, but it's theoretical. It's not real because it's not happening. So even though we have objective forms, the action, right? The Ruach HaEmunah, the objective manifestations of our ideals in the form of behaviors, well, we may have all of that, but we need a society to do those things. We need to be able to interact with the people, the places, and the things around us, and the ideas and the concepts around us in that way. Otherwise, we're limited to our own existence, and perhaps even worse, we're limited to our own existence with a proper vision and perspective on what we could be and what we could be doing and how people could be interacting with themselves, their peers, and the people around them. So the Ruach HaLeumi is what receives the first three and becomes a system for their expression and takes upon a very unique identity depending on the people who are in that system and who make it up and what those ideals are and what their larger pursuits are. So to summarize this idea of Rav Kook, which was not a simple idea, it was not an easy idea. It took us a while to really work through and iron out some of the more difficult and abstract concepts. But essentially, the way that Rav Kook sees the mitzvot are a response to our absolute and our eternal spiritual necessities. These parts of ourselves that will always be us, they're tied not to our temporal positions and not to the aspects of ourselves that are society influenced or prompted. These are things that are deeply embedded in human nature. They will never not be embedded in human nature, and therefore they will never not be relevant. And moreover, these are things that that we long for constantly. These are things that we cannot envision a life without. We can't even envision a day without some of these things. We don't even know what that means. What is behavior that is not striving for a greater version of who you are right now? What is a life that doesn't look to encroach upon perfection or impede positively upon the existences around you? We don't even know what that means. We don't know what life looks like when if you're entirely self-contained, limited to yourself, and have no larger system of interaction or no objective manifestations of what you believe or even beliefs. We don't know what existence looks like without these things. They are objective parts of our human condition, and we will never achieve spiritual satisfaction if we cannot respond to these four levels. So what are the mitzvot? The mitzvot are the most brilliant, divinely designed system to be the antidote to the existential suffering of the human condition in the realms of spirituality, right? We need these things, and mitzvot as a large system, as an entire system, not just a single mitzvah, but as an entire system, they function together to provide us with the opportunity to strive to emulate God, aspire towards His perfection, reach beyond ourselves, become more than what we are, encroach upon perfection, encroach upon infinity, encroach upon immortality, become more than what we are, extend ourselves into the existences of the people and the things around us, do good, be a force that operates beyond itself and that is relevant in the existences of the things around us, have objective manifestations of those values that we're aspiring toward, and having a larger system in which to act and act out these values and put them into practice in a way that we can impact the people around us, the things around us, and have some sort of mutually agreed upon framework for operation in the image of the ideal that we're pursuing. That is Rav Kook's vision for mitzvot. Now, he takes time out. I mean, again, there's an entire book written on just trying to address this point, because from here he goes on to explaining how that looks, how the mitzvot do that, how practically the mitzvot that we have and we know and we practice every day give us that framework that we crave in such a perfect sense. If people want that, definitely let me hear some feedback. We're already, we're close to an hour in, so I'm going to stop here. But if people want to explore that idea as well in a later podcast, let me know. And perhaps we'll get into that was really the theory, and now we'd get into the application as far as where does that look in the mitzvot, and how do I start to see the mitzvot as things that, even if I don't realize, I'm not designed to live without. And if I do embrace them, then my life becomes qualitatively more substantial and more satisfactory, because they are the objective tools for fulfillment and fulfilling holes that we have because of the fact that we're humans. And I'll reiterate just one final point, because in my eyes, it's the most beautiful takeaway. But if you recognize that there is some sort of deficiency in meaning or in value in your own life that is basically intolerable, because if you feel like you're not living a very valuable existence, on any level, it is, varying degrees of intolerable. And if you realize that will always be the case, that there is a hole, a certain lack of meaning or a certain lack of existential purpose in your life, and that is causing you suffering, maybe not now, maybe in the future, and maybe as you get older, perhaps it will cause you suffering, and you identify within mitzvot the antidote to that suffering because it is the pathway to purpose, then regardless of the difficulty in the mitzvot, you will happily weather that difficulty in realization that it is significantly easier than contending with what we feel we lack by not following them and by not having that purpose. So again, give me some feedback if you want to go on with this idea and look into the more practical application realm of where we find these things within mitzvot.